I apologise, this is one of the schools that's on a tiny site, one of its more far-flung outposts. If there's any comfort to any of you who got lost, can you hear me at the back? Any comfort? I actually had to ask how to get here myself. It's not a good sign after all these years. Anyway, welcome. I'm Tony Travers from LSE London, and I'm merely here to chair this afternoon's event. It's the final in a number of seminars on the private rented sector in the UK. The earlier meetings, some of them at least, have tried to examine the issue in an international context as well. And at the end of this evening, there will be the launch of a book which brings together some of that expertise, including some of the external contributors, the overseas contributors, I should say. All I'd say is that, it's just by way of introduction, is that in the brief period that these seminars have been going on this year, there's no doubt that housing, always bubbling away as a political issue, has clearly begun again to rise up the political agenda. Interestingly, this is partly, I think, because of clearly the new government, with its extraordinary activist mentality, is looking at housing as an issue, but at the same time is reforming the planning system with a view to creating more housing, or less, depending on who you listen to, and also radically reforming the benefits system, all in one go, and reforming the benefits system that will also have implications for housing, particularly in big cities, and most particularly in London. So, as they say, couldn't be a better time to be considering this issue once again. What we're going to do today is to have a brief presentation from Kath Scanlon and Christine Whitehead, sitting here to my right, not very good at directions, right. They'll speak for about 20-25 minutes, and then the rest of the panel will join me here. Each will then make a short contribution, then there'll be an opportunity for more general discussion and debate, argument, and so on. That's it really. Pat, Christine, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Tony. I'm going to start with the negatives, and Kath is going to go on to the positives. As some of you all know, we've had four sessions so far, looking first at the UK and then looking at certain lessons from abroad from particular groups of people. But at the same time, we were putting together written materials from a range of countries, 15 countries altogether, to look at the comparisons and to see the extent to which the messages which were coming out of the seminars were also the messages which came out of more detailed analyses of the countries. And the It doesn't work by doing that. So we will have to do it there. So what we wanted to do today was to move it right on to say what everybody kept saying at the end of each session. We don't just want to know some facts. We want to know where we might go in terms of policy, what we might be leading to saying to politicians in this complex world. So the first thing is some very simple things which we all probably know. Private renting has been growing in the UK very rapidly, now 17% of the English housing stock, growing faster than almost any country, certainly faster than any of the other countries that we looked at. The issue though, in terms of what we're going to get to in the end, is not about size as such, it's about the sustainability and the operation of that sector. And the reason why the private rented sector has been growing so rapidly is seen mostly to be about what isn't going on in other sectors. So it's about the decline in the owner-occupied sector and about, if at best, stability of the social rented sector at a time when the numbers of households are growing and the stock is not keeping pace. And to that extent, I think we can say that the discussion, not always, but nearly always, the discussion in the UK is fundamentally a negative discussion. It's a discussion which almost always says that you're pushed into the private rented sector, but a subsector is choice, the mobile and the transitional, but the rest of the population would probably rather be in another tenure. And similarly, that many landlords, although that may be less so on that supply side, many landlords are there by default because they can't do actually what they want to do with their property. But if we look at other countries, and increasingly in Britain, it's not that this is always a negative story now, the pull factors are more obvious. The why people should want to be in private rented accommodation, why people should want to invest in private rented accommodation, does these pull factors are there. And it's not just about easy access and flexibility, it's also about risk management and portfolios, and why should individuals take these very large scale risks on in specific investments. So what might we see as being the sort of underlying problems coming out of our first discussion? The sector is growing, but rents in many parts of the country are still rising very rapidly, so it doesn't suggest that 17% is actually the equilibrium size for today. We haven't got a blind clue what the equilibrium size is for the next 30 years. That's a different story. Secondly, and very, very much the consumer story, that there's very uneven, that's the generous way of putting it, quality in the private rented sector. A lot of, particularly the stuff coming in the last 10, 15 years, has been reasonably good quality, but quite a lot of it is not. And the professionalism of management is mentioned by every international person you ever see. Anybody you meet who's had experience of a private rented sector here and elsewhere says the professionalism is pretty low. We've got less new build from the buy-to-let market. We've got fragmented ownership of multi-family apartment blocks, which makes a lot of difference in what you can do, and limited security of tenure. Not that the legal framework doesn't allow it, but that the system doesn't provide it. So what questions should we be asking for the future? What do we think is going to go on if circumstances do change? Is 17% a sort of reasonable level? Can developers actually fill the gap which has come in, arising from the fact that the buy-to-let market as an investment market has disappeared for a while? What should be the role of institutional and long-term investors? Should we reduce barriers between the rented sectors? Should we be always be talking private and social, or are we talking about a more integrated sector? What should be the sector's role in housing more vulnerable households and lower income households? And can the market be expected to provide a range of tenures, a range of leases and securities? And what I'm going to talk about is correcting the negative assumptions, and then Kath is going to go on to the positive. Learning from abroad, we thought that we came up with six main things where, if you ask your average politician or you ask your average person in the street, our understanding of what is going on elsewhere would be wrong, or would be inadequately nuanced, if you want to be careful about it. So the first is that institutional investment does not dominate in any major country in the private rented sector. The only country that it dominates is in Switzerland, and in Switzerland the constraints on other tenures are such that there is, and the institutions are required to invest in the private rented sector. So it's hardly what you call the obvious comparator. Germany and America, you get lots of company landlords, lots of other types of landlords, but you do not get vast amounts of institutional. Secondly, and I think the one which is most immediately relevant to the GLA debate at the present time, is that regulation is not inherently associated with a smaller and poor, more poorly operating sector, or even in a sector where the pressures are for decline. You've got countries where a regulatory framework has worked to provide landlords with a reasonable rate of return, with reasonable, stable expectations of rents on the one hand, and tenants to have varying levels of security up to and including lifetime security in systems which are seen to be reasonably viable. The third, which follows from that in a sense, is that private renting is not in most other countries, or many other countries, not just for the young and the mobile and the ones who can't get in anywhere else, but it can be a tenure of choice, and it can be a tenure of choice for the sorts of households which we tend to think have to be in the social rented sector or have to be in owner occupation if they are to get the stability that they require. And that leads to another one which I am less comfortable with, and Kath may come back on this, but the private renting is not inherently unsuitable for the vulnerable. There are plenty of countries where private providers provide what we define as social housing, or for the groups that are in social housing. But they do normally do it with the help of quite strong licensing frameworks and quite generous income support. So the question really is this a social sector which happens to be owned by the private sector rather than something different? And I leave the negatives of that. The fifth one is bigger is not necessarily better. We're looking for optimal sizes given the nature of the system in Britain and elsewhere. So if we've got a government that genuinely, whether we like it or not, wants to constrain, you know, wants to tax owner occupation more, then we would find that we would end up with a larger private rented sector. So if the transactions costs in owner occupation increase, then the private rented sector will increase, etc. So the scale, you can never answer the question which was put to me by David Bill about what size should the sector be. There is not an answer to that question. So the objective should be to meet the full range of demands and needs. Now, some of what is negative is inherently also what's positive, but Kath can be much more positive about it.
I will go very quickly through the main points of what we distilled out of our discussions about how private renting operates in a range of other countries, including the States and most of the major European countries. First, private renting needs a range of investors. As Christine said, there's no country where institutional investors dominate, and so the government policy attempts over the last few decades to increase the amount of institutional investors as a kind of panacea for the problems of the private rented sector don't really find much support in what's happening abroad. There, in many countries, individuals and couples often own big portfolios of private rented dwellings, either entire blocks or estates, as their kind of pension provision for the future. And we need to recognize that that's going to be always part of the system here and design a kind of fiscal framework that supports that. Second, regulation is not an evil word necessarily. There are many countries with much more broadly based private rented sectors where a range of household types live in the sector, middle class, middle income households, with much stronger regulation than it currently is the case in Britain. We're not necessarily suggesting that returning to the kinds of regulation that applied here in the past is the way to go, but we are saying that we can't make a snap judgment or a kind of ideological judgment that regulation is always associated with shrinking sectors, sectors that don't work, sectors where landlords are fleeing and trying to sell out because they can't make a return. That isn't really the case in a lot of countries. Third, that in places like Germany, places like Switzerland and France, families and older households live in private renting, especially in urban areas, not just young people and those who are looking to live somewhere for a year or two. In those countries, normally the default form of lease is an indefinite lease that lasts until the tenant decides to move out, and the landlords can only break it for a certain number of reasons that are set out in the law. So there's very strong security of tenure for the renter, and that is something analogous as possible in the UK, but now is very rarely found. So that's something we need to think about. How about the very low-income households living in the private rented sector? Well, in Britain, the very bottom end of the private rented sector is a pretty awful place to be, and that is also the case in a lot of countries. France is one example that comes to mind. Those countries where it does work, there has to be quite a bit of support for the tenants and fairly strong regulation of the landlords. How about getting new supply? Well, there's something that needs to be said, first of all, here about supply, and that is that in this country, any privately owned housing can be either rented or owner-occupied. There's no legal distinction between the two of them. There's no permission required for an owner to rent out their home, and conversely, they can move back into it whenever they want to. So it's difficult to talk about new supply specifically for the private rented sector, although clearly there are kinds of developments that are more appealing to private landlords and lots of developments that are probably designed with them specifically in mind. In a lot of countries, the framework is different. There are legal restrictions on moving between private rented ownership and owner occupation, so we're not comparing like with like. The other point to make is that in many countries, particularly Denmark is one, there blocks of flats can only be owned by, or blocks of flats are in single ownership. They're not generally sold individually as what we would call an owner-occupied flat here or a condominium in the States. And so that shapes their rental sector and means that individual owners have a larger pool of properties in one area, and they're easier to manage, and often they can build up a brand. Looking at how to transfer that experience to the UK context might make it more attractive for bigger investors who are looking for large-scale investments, attract investment in REITs, and so on. And in the States and Australia, and Germany is another example, private landlords get generous tax deductions in order to build private rented housing that is specifically designated for renting to low-income households. Usually there's a time limit, 30 or 40 years, after which the housing can go back into the private rented sector and be rented at market rents. But this provides a kind of privately owned social housing, a kind of hybrid that we haven't experienced here, but it might be something to look at. Finally, we looked at tax treatment and found the same thing that lots of others who've looked at this issue have found, that tax treatment of private landlords is more generous in a lot of countries than it is in the UK. There are two areas in particular. First, a lot of countries allow landlords to offset their losses on rental income or on rental activities against their income from other types of activity or from employment. That's called negative gearing. It's not allowed in Britain. The second is that several countries offer depreciation allowances to landlords, and again, it's something that's not available here. But we want to make clear that any incentives in this area have to fit in with the UK tax system. It's not just a question of taking a provision and plugging it in. The forces that we see in demographically, in terms of growth of population and households particularly, income distribution and labor market migration, all point to increasing demand over the next 10 to 15 years for private rented housing. Will there be a corresponding supply response? Well, investors need a stable, predictable rate of return if they are going to inject funds into the sector. Finally, the scale of the sector is not just a function of the policies that apply to private renting. It's inevitably tightly bound up with the kind of policies that apply to owner occupation and to social housing. And then beyond the housing market completely, investors are looking at what kind of returns they can make on other assets as well as on rented housing. So let's not lose sight of the fact that it's just one piece in a much more complex jigsaw. And this is the final slide. No country has everything right. When we look across the channel to Germany and France, we might think, oh, their system is clearly much better. They've got lots more middle-income households in private renting. Why doesn't it work that way here? But equally, when they look to us, they see lots of advantages in our system that seem to make theirs look sclerotic and inflexible. The countries that do have bigger, well-operated private rented sectors tend to be prosperous countries with generous state welfare support and not much pressure in the housing market. And Germany is an example here. Berlin, for example, has hundreds of thousands of vacant but good quality dwellings, and that offers a kind of freedom in the market that just doesn't obtain in a city like London. On the other hand, there are countries with big private rented sectors that also have very volatile housing markets, and where the poor are concentrated in private renting, that clearly isn't a model that we want to follow. International comparisons of policy are fascinating and illuminating, but to transfer policies from one national context to another is complex and never as straightforward as the comparisons would at first suggest. So we've identified some interesting themes here, some potential areas that need further investigation, but now the hard work really starts to talk about what would work in the UK, what we think is the best course to follow, and what really has potential from here in the next steps to policymakers. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both. Right. We're going to move straight on now to what is termed here, what happens to policy, comments and discussion. So we'll get some news from each of the four members of the panel. We can now deal with the remainder over here. Start to join me. These four panel members are Michael Ball, Professor of Urban and Property Economics at the University of Reading. Yolanda Barnes, who's Director of Residential Research at Savills. Richard Parker, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and Toby Lloyd, Policy Director at Shelter. That's the order of those written down. Michael, would you like to speak first?
Yes, sure. Can everybody hear me if I sit down? I'm a discussant, so I should be standing up like the grand speaker. And I just wanted to make a number of comments. And most of all, I've had a sneak preview of the book, and I've been at most of the seminars, and it's a fascinating piece of work. And it's actually got a lot of more in-depth stuff about what happens in the rest of the world than I've seen anywhere else. And I do a lot of international research, and it's not just simply the language that creates barriers, but there are huge barriers to gathering this information and analysis. So I really think the organisers have to be congratulated for doing a very good job on enlightening us on what's happening. And the big thing I think that comes out is that the private rented sectors around, when I was a young man, I was told this thing was declining, you know, it was just going to go away one day, and that was it. Well, as I declined, it grew. And, so it's clearly not the way things are working out. But when we look abroad, there's some really interesting things, because housing, private rented sectors in many other countries have been pretty much like they are, obviously with a few bells and whistles, for a very long time. Our modern rented sector started in the late 80s, early 90s, so it was a baby for a while. It was a teenager in the 2000s and had an absolutely wild time, and is now reaching young adulthood, and like many young adults, it's very uncertain what to do with itself, and is massively constrained, particularly as there's a rather large financial economic crisis hanging around its ears. So when we look at the PRS and when we make comparisons, I think we have to recognise that, and recognise that ours is in some sense different, and it's been evolving, and it's been evolving in particular circumstances. And the buy-to-let boom is very important within that understanding of those particular circumstances. I very much enjoyed the explanation of the very different roles that the private rented sector plays across the world. There are obviously key important institutional differences here, and the great thing about saying institutional differences, there are so many of them, you can never finish the argument ever. But all the same, big important ones are clearly of great stature in terms of us understanding what the private rented sector does. The presentation now just mentioned one of them, the role of the social rented sector, and one of the questions we might wish to ask is not about the future of the private rented sector, but simply the future of rented housing, because there's clearly going to be a lot of convergence going on in UK in time to come, immaterial of who's actually in power, but definitely with the current lot in power. Now, I think that's very important. And Cindy, when we look at comparisons, and one of the things I thought was good about what's been discussed is it's not simply facts, it's interpretation. And again, like institutions, there are zillions of interpretations, but it's very important to be aware of that and to understand that, so you can't just simply say in one country they have bigger beer glasses than we do, and this is an outrage, or whatever it is one wish to pick on in terms of the types of comparisons. And it's very important to remember that market dynamics really matter. I'm not too sure I believe German house price data, but if it is actually true, the real price of a German home has dropped by a third in about 25 years. Now, me, if I was somebody starting off in life, I'd think, I'm going to stay a renter. And at the end of my life, I would say, what a cool move. And in terms of, you know, there clearly is, you've got to understand what's happening. And the situation of Berlin's very informative in that. It doesn't mean to say you don't look elsewhere, but you've got to put all these things in context. So I think that's very important. Now, in terms of the different types of contracts, I entirely agree that regulation is one thing within that context. It's also important to remember that markets tend to do things without regulation, that there tends to be some sort of behaviour. And I'm going to cling on to one statistic here. The English Housing Survey says that tenants on average who stay more than 3 years in the same flat have about 10% less rental payment than do ones more recently moved in. Now, that's a classic example of landlords not wanting people to move and responding on rents there. And they don't want them to move just because they like a smile on their face or whatever. It's the fact that it costs a lot of money for a landlord to have big churn in their properties, and therefore they're prepared to negotiate. It often isn't a negotiation, it's simply not going on to the not raising rents at some time in the future. So those sorts of dynamics, I think, are important, and we should be aware of them when we look at and debate about regulations.
One final point in terms of general things, and I want to do a slightly doom and gloom thing as my conclusion after that. One final point is, in the UK, because we have long-running trend increases in house prices, albeit with an awful lot of volatility, it's not just simply the tax benefits of home ownership that encourage home ownership, because as long as you can cover your risks, if you go into home ownership, you're locking yourself into a particular level of housing costs, which can be very, very substantial over time, as most homeowners in London will be aware. And so you do get wealth benefits, even if those wealth benefits are taxed, but you also get a level of security you can never get in the private rented sector, just simply because it would not be a viable investment option to freeze rents at the level that you bought your home at. And that's a very important thing. And that occurs because of our rising house prices. In other words, housing shortages matter when looking at tenures. And that's a very important thing, I think, we need to be aware of. Now, in terms of housing shortages, my gloomy bit is I've been doing some work, but also other people have been noticing that the buy-to-let boom was incredibly important in reviving the private rented sector, and then the home ownership crash was in terms of reducing the amount of housing. But what it meant is, and this is a sad thing to say, is that rents are way below optimal levels in UK. I read in the newspapers that rents rose last year by 5%, and the market's clearly picking up. In fact, some numbers make it bigger or a lot bigger, but I use 5% because that's the rate of inflation. In other words, real rents didn't rise at all. And in fact, if you look at some of the indices coming out that have been pushed out, real rents on average in UK are about 10% less than they were at the peak. House prices in real terms for UK average about 30% less than the peak. So most of those buy-to-let landlords didn't make a very good investment. In other words, anybody who bought from 2004 onwards, I would have thought, not anybody, but the average person, should I say, who bought from 2000 onwards, has lost an awful lot of money. Now, that is going to have big implications for the way we see the private rented sector in the future. When the market picks up, frustrated sellers who rented because they couldn't sell will be selling off their rental property, but also other landlords will be thinking, hey, where's the return going to come from in the future? And if you do a little bit of arithmetic and a few surveys, you'll notice that the return that's required in the UK at the moment is very, very large relative to the returns we see in other countries. And that's the big difference there, is the tax system is very, very different. So I think whether we like it or not, Tony was saying housing's come up as an issue, but I think in the next few years, investment in the private rented sector is going to become a very substantial issue. The newspapers will still be writing, because that's what they're supposed to do, about invest in buy-to-let, it's the best thing you can do. Don't go on holiday to New York, buy that flat, or whatever. But it's if you're harder and more hard-nosed about it, that is not the case. When returns grow in other investments, the smart move might not be the PRS unless we can do something about the tax system. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Are you therefore indirectly suggesting that you think that this growth will top out and start to decline, we're going to decline at some point soon?
It all depends how many houses we build, because if we don't build any houses at all, house prices will continue doing that. And it's as Christine said, it all depends on so many other things. But there are clearly high risks involved in it. And if we want decent housing and a private rented sector where there isn't poor standards and so on, we've got to think both about supply and about returns to landlord, and think about both in a very serious way.
Okay, very good, thank you. Next speaker, Yolanda, the floor is yours.
Well, I have to say, when I was first invited to attend a seminar on the private rental sector, I did have a sense of foreboding, because I've been attending gatherings like these for the last 22 years. And I really want to acknowledge the authors for basically coming up with something new that we didn't know about before. I think it's a real achievement, and it's great to be sitting here and talking about something new and having a real insight, new angle on the sector from overseas. I think also what I love about this is that a few myths have been dispelled. There's so many myths in the housing market, and I just love it when they're explained, so thank you and well done for that as well. I started this morning actually talking to the Council of Mortgage Lenders about the first-time buyer being an endangered species. So I feel that I've almost sort of come full circle, sort of ending the day here, as it were. But I think that's a very important finding in the report, that at the moment, although the private rental sector in the UK has grown very, very substantially, it has been through push factors. Factors that might not be, you know, thought of as an ideal. It's not been choice-based. And as far as we can see, actually, not just with the state of mortgage lending, but all sorts of other factors coming together, it is very easy for us to predict that the demand for renting will continue to increase. And, you know, it's very easy, it trips off our tongue. 20% by 2020 seems highly probable. But the big question, which I think is where this word sustainability is, it all sustainable in the title, everything now has to have sustainable in the title. But it's a very important word, and I wish somebody had realised that when we were talking about development, but that's a whole other issue. I think this question of sustainable has to be seen, I think, in the context of whether we can actually have this demand, which I think is very easy to foresee, actually matched by supply. And I think that's the balance of the policy challenge at the moment, is a sustainable rental market has to be one where, broadly speaking, over time, demand for renting is in balance with the supply of stock. And I think it's very interesting that you spoke about regulation, and regulation not necessarily being a killer. But of course, the plain fact is, in my view, that regulation very definitely did kill off, the wrong regulation killed off the private renting sector in this country in the past. And we've got to be extremely careful that new regulation doesn't do the same thing. I think, therefore, that from a policy point of view, I'd be wanting to see regulation that allows for ownership and new investment, and perhaps goes hand in hand, as rights and responsibilities do, with maybe a little leeway on the tax side. So in return for some kind of tax incentives, the regulation goes, as it were, hand in hand. And I do think we have to continue to be very careful that any regulation doesn't kill off the sector for one reason or another. I think one of the most interesting things as well, which I think is going to be a real challenge for policymakers to deal with, is this finding that actually, no matter where you look, one of the things that is similar and not different is the size or the number of private individuals involved as landlords. And somehow or other, we have to, like it or not, embrace private individual landlords and allow for their participation in the sector. I think there are, as it were, glimmers of hope. And I wouldn't say, therefore, we have to solely brace those landlords. I think there is plenty of scope for a more, let's not call it institutional, but certainly corporate involvement in the sector. And I now hear colleagues at Savills talking about land release, that big sort of issue in land supply, actually being contingent upon a rental market releasing the land. In other words, hard-nosed developers are actually looking to provide rental accommodation in order to release big sites. Now, this is a revolutionary change, absolutely revolutionary. So I am quite hopeful that something's going to happen there. I suppose the final point that I want to make is with regard to actually sort of next steps, really. And I think the work that's been done here is fantastic. But one of the things is that is beginning to emerge is a kind of question. I sensed a question behind everything. Are we actually talking about the right thing? We've already mentioned, is there really a separation, or going to continue to be a separation between social housing and private renting? I mean, you could argue that a lot of social housing is private because it's funded by private equity, of course, in the form of loans, lending, whatever. And that started happening in the housing stock transfers decades ago. There's also a question for me about how blurred the lines are going to get between private renting and owner occupation. You could say they already are, and I think some of the increase, and unfortunately I've not managed to dig out data, if anyone can help me here I'd be very grateful, but our strong suspicion is that we've seen a rise in what we're calling let to rent. In other words, people renting out their homes that they own in order to rent something more appropriate, which is quite difficult in the private rented sector. So that's an area. But also, of course, emerging products and potential for shared equity, co-investment, all the different things that this is called, but some element of hybrid renting and owning, or at least participation. The idea of actually establishing states, capital states, as it were, in a rented, essentially otherwise rented product, and the whole range of sort of rainbow of products in between there. And I do think that we do need to change our thinking about this. It's a very late 20th century thing to become so siloed and specialist and talk about all these different sectors, commercial property versus residential, social housing versus private sector. I think what we're going to see in this century is much more sort of budding, emerging, and interesting solutions. So, I'm looking forward to some imaginative solutions coming from my sector. And thank you very much for providing some evidence upon which to base that.
Okay, thanks, Yolanda. I mean, the last point you made there about this sort of developing spectrum of types of housing, do you think that would over time begin to inform the way people looked at these different types of housing? I mean, that the in a sense, if there's a spectrum between owner occupation and private renting and social renting, that over time social attitudes will change.
I think social attitudes already have. I mean, just talking to the younger people in my team, there is just not the stigma that might have been attached to renting that there was when I was their age. So I think things have already changed a lot, partly needs driven, but I think partly because we are becoming more cosmopolitan and you know, we're very aware of all these different international experiences.
Okay, very good. Right, Richard.
Okay, thank you, Tony. I've sort of going to prepare a new script, having listened to
him.
I think the publication, and I saw somebody draw something, is a very useful contribution to the discussion, and I sincerely hope it helps inform policymakers and politicians in both their understanding of the market and how, and I'll move on to this, how government may respond in the future, or indeed whether it should. But and I particularly remind myself of a number of years ago going out to Hammarby in Stockholm to look at the eco town there, and coming back with some government advisers and thinking that they could just import what the Swedish were doing here, and it would make a great deal of sense for understanding the different cultural and psychological approach the Swedish have to living in Hammarby, which is one of the reasons why I think some of the eco town proposals and others really didn't work very well at all. They also failed to understand that some of these big projects were completely underwritten in the first instance by government or local government. By local government. In terms of the policy perspective, I think there's a great need for developing understanding, as I referred to at the beginning. It's a number of years ago now that Sir Bob Kerslake, when he was chief exec of the HCA, launched initial dialogue with the market about private rented with a view of attracting interest from institutional investors. To get anything developed in government, I think you need to get the content and the timing right, and we probably got it wrong on both counts, actually, but certainly the latter, I think, on the time, because a report went into the CLG during the period before the last general election, and that period further, and I think the work and the interest in it drifted, and it slowly dehydrated and decomposed on someone's shelf in the CLG, which was particularly disappointing. But I think if we're going to address the void that exists between demand and supply now, that void in understanding in government needs to change also. And I do think government needs to respond in some way, because I see no interest or activity or understanding or evidence so far that the private sector, whether groups of funders or other independent entities, are going to come together of their own volition, on any scale or size whatsoever, to fill this gap in the market that the report identifies. And there are a number of reasons for that, and I won't go into all of them, but at this point, but I will touch on a few of them. I think it's also, I think, important to understand why we are where we are now, and the report sort of touches on this, but during that, I think, second era of municipal magnificence after the Second World War, it was, you know, it was the building of public housing on large scales that displaced the private rented sector in the UK, and subsequently fiscal measures and grant and subsidy to social housing, you know, removed the capacity, I think, on a large scale for the private sector to respond. That was certainly very different in countries like Australia and the US. But just come back to what I think needs to happen. Well, the need is there. There's no doubt, and we refer to that. I do think we still lack some real data on what exactly that need is, where it is, how much people can afford, and the types of people we need to house. And if you took to overseas investors, and I was in the Far East and the Middle East earlier in the summer, they're very attracted to investing in London for lots of reasons, and they've got some very significant sums that they can move around. Move around the world, but they have a real difficulty understanding where this demand is, how latent it is, how real it is, where it's going to crystallise, and the macroeconomic backdrop is slightly unhelpful too. But if we are going to move on, I think, and this is why I think there is a role for government, and I don't particularly agree with Tony that this government is particularly activist. I think it's been active, rather than activist, but I think a proposition needs to be built or taken to the market around the issues the report addresses, but particularly on scale and affordability, on quality, and the extent to which regulation needs to be applied to make the sector deliver and protect tenants. And without that, I just fear that any development will be piecemeal, and we won't be starting to address the issues that the report outlines. And I think they're very real issues, because we're in a very difficult economic situation. We could have a nil growth or very low growth economy for the medium to long term, and you know, within that fiscal environment, I think it's very unlikely that any future government will have the capacity to there won't be any proceeds of growth to invest in housing the way it does to protect social housing currently. So we need to start to think far more creatively. And I just fear that the current government and people in government don't quite understand enough about the importance of this issue to respond to it in the way that I've outlined, and that's why I think this report is a very useful one. I think my early days of working with Bob Kerslake at the HCA, James Wardlow from Goldman Sachs is here, was also working with Bob around this, was at the time, if we're going to attract institutional interest, you know, government needs to take an institutional lead. And I don't mean, you know, it builds it, underwrites it, but I do think it needs to frame the investment proposition if we are going to see a market response of the scale that I think the country needs. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And I probably should have said the government started doing lots of things rather than anything else. That's a fairer way of putting it. So I take
correction.
No. I richly deserve it. Okay. Very good. All right. Thanks for that. And last but not least, Toby.
Thank you very much. And can I second what everyone else has said, and very much welcome this report, with all the usual caveats that it is very difficult to learn direct lessons from a report for all reasons that other people have set out, but that doesn't mean it's not interesting and extremely useful to pick up on some of those lessons. With the shelter, a very interesting environment at the moment, for all the obvious reasons that other people have raised, i.e. it's growing very fast. it's growing at unprecedented rates at the moment, and importantly for us, it's increasingly housing a lot of people that it didn't used to house until quite recently. There are now 1 million households with children, families with children, living in the private rented sector. That figure has almost doubled in the last 3 years. Okay, so if the sector itself is growing fast, that kind of subsector, households with children, and I do ask you to consider, would you want to raise a family? My daughter's just started school last week, in fact. I would be horrified at the thought of knowing that I had absolutely no guarantee that I would be able to keep her in the same school for more than 6 months or 12 months at a time. And you know, the educational figures are very, very stark on the impact of people being forced, their children being forced to move school on a regular basis. So we are very concerned about the fact that a huge chunk of the population are living in a sector in which they have very, very little prospect of just knowing that they're going to be able to stay there. Okay? And that is partly an unfair concern, and we recognise this, and the landlords will be very quick to point out that the vast majority of tenancies are ended by the tenants, and that is true. Yeah? And as Mike pointed out, landlords prefer to have long-staying tenants as long as they keep paying the rent. Of course they do. It's easier for them. It's always easier to deal with someone that you know than someone that you don't. There are obvious financial advantages. You don't have the cost of churn and so forth. You know, it's a winner all round. And yet, any suggestion that they should offer longer tenancies seems to come up against the brick wall. So we're very interested in how we can kind of unpick that conundrum. Why is it that there seem to be such barriers to offering longer tenancies? And I'd be very interested if anyone here has examples from last time we had a kind of big tenancy law revolution in the 80s, when I'm sure lots of people at the time then said, oh look, you know, these new ASTs, but they're in for a legal minimum of 6 months, but lots of them will be offered for far, far longer. And I don't have the evidence, but if anyone here does, I'm sure there were those debates then. And of course we now know that the legal minimum inevitably becomes the practical maximum that anyone is prepared to offer. So we are concerned about that, the sheer length of time there, but both in very real terms, but also just in that psychological sense. In fact, when I was a student at LSE 10 years ago, I started a tenancy, which in a private tenancy, which I actually ended up staying in for 7 years, and my housemates are still in that house. That tenancy has been running for 10 years. Okay, so very, very stable, lovely house, great place. We never had more than sometimes we had a 6 month tenancy, sometimes we had a 12 month tenancy. So we never had any security that we would be there. The landlord occasionally made threatening noises about ending it. So, and fundamentally, it does undermine you psychologically. It undermines your incentive to invest in a place, both kind of physically in the fabric of the building, but also kind of socially in that community, because you never quite know how long you're going to be there. We're also concerned about the private rented sector because of conditions. Right? This is by far the worst sector in the country for poor conditions. 40% of the private rented sector doesn't meet the decent home standard, you know, far, far higher than either social or owner-occupied housing. And that includes almost 1 million private rented homes that have what's known as Category 1 hazards, i.e. ones that are, you know, really seriously dangerous to people's life and health. It's also, of course, a sector in which people suffer the worst form of management. Again, not across the board, plenty of very, very decent landlords, but let's face it, this is where, you know, the rogue landlords camp out, because they know that they can. There is absolutely, well, virtually no enforcement against rogue landlords, and we know this is a huge and growing problem, massively underreported. And we recently did a Freedom of Information request into this question, just trying to find out what local authorities knew about criminal landlord activity in the area. This is just not just kind of poor quality, but actual criminal activity. We've had 7.5 million people have experienced criminal landlord activity in the last 10 years, and very, very few of those came to any sort of prosecution. You're talking about 100 cases a year on average, often resulting in kind of £100 fine or something like that. So yeah, the incentives on landlords to behave well are actually pretty slim, especially given the market side pressures, which means that there are huge demand for private rented housing at the moment, simply because there is nothing else. So I very much welcome this report and the other commentators here pointing out that the demand for the private rented sector is not really demand for private rented housing. It is a fact. It is an effect of what is happening elsewhere in the housing market. This all leads on to the obvious question of, well, how do you improve it? And it is difficult not to kind of start reaching for that regulatory toolbox. So I think it's worth kind of unpacking some of those myths, and I do very much welcome that kind of comparative example that demonstrates that A, regulation isn't a panacea, it won't solve everything, but also that it doesn't automatically kill everything off. And I think we have a real problem in this country about the kind of quality of our debates around regulation, partly because we seem to lurch from one extreme to the other. So we went from having the most regulated private sector in the world to the most unregulated. Yeah? And so we tend to assume it's one or the other. Whereas actually, as the comparative examples show, there are a whole host of options in between those extreme points. And so we shouldn't take at face value the assertion that the kind of slightest hint of regulation will automatically mean landlords fleeing the sector. And by the way, what does actually landlords fleeing the sector mean? I mean, are we actually talking about them burning down the houses? This is a good that is going to stay there. Presumably we're talking about landlords choosing to sell those properties, either to owner-occupiers or to private renters. Now, if we're not assuming that it is absolutely essential that this property that private renting must be preserved as such, what's wrong with that? Is there any real problem with landlords exiting on an individual basis? In fact, given the quality of some of the landlords, I think quite a few of them would be quite glad to see the back of. So, you know, I want to kind of push back against that assumption that regulation will inevitably lead to some calamitous collapse. Finally, though, I think we do recognise that there does need to be some sort of quid pro quo here. If we're thinking about how we can improve the deal for tenants, we do have to think seriously about, you know, what's in it for landlords. And I absolutely hear the points about rental return. I have to say I do slightly challenge Michael's assertion that the problem is that rents are too low. If the yield is too low, I would suggest, possibly heretically, that maybe that's because the price is too high.
Oh, yes.
rather than the fact that these tenants have already seen 66% increases in rents since the year 2000, while over the same period of which wages increased by 35%. So, you know, effectively we're seeing people's incomes being dramatically squeezed by rent increases. I would suggest that maybe the problem there, again, is not actually in the private rental sector per se, but in overall house price inflation. But we do recognise there needs to be some quid pro quo, and so just as some kind of ideas to throw out there, this is not kind of job policy, this is just things I've been thinking about. What is it that would motivate landlords to provide longer tenancies, either voluntarily or to accept a regulatory regime that required longer tenancies and a bit more security? I think landlords have quite justifiable concerns about whether it's possible to get rid of bad tenants who aren't paying their rent and trashing the place and causing problems. Okay? So yeah, maybe we need to do something about the court side of things to actually give landlords reassurances that, sorry, you know, if you end up with a bad tenant, you're not going to be stuck with them forever. I think we'd be, you know, open to those suggestions. I think there are questions about, you know, the tax structure. Although again, I think we actually probably need to be concentrating more on lowering the purchase price rather than subsidising landlords into the private rented sector. And then, you know, finally, are there things that we need to be doing to just kind of actually speak to landlords? And I'm struck by the fact that the landlord sector is almost impossible to reach. Right? And I go to a lot of events. I don't know if there's anyone here from either the professional bodies, who are the main professional bodies being National Landlords Association and the Residential Landlords Association, who we have excellent relations with, you know, do a lot of good work. They represent 2% of landlords. Mm. So given that we have to accept that landlords are and will continue to be largely small-scale investors, how do we even know what they want? A lot of the time I think we take the word of those that represent actually quite a small subset are larger, major investors in the sector as being representative of the landlord industry, and a lot of them aren't. So just on, and then finally on the tax point, I think we would be willing to look at to consider options that do give landlords a better tax deal, although I worry that most of them wouldn't accept that, for the simple reason that while we technically might actually have relatively high tax on landlords in this country, most of them don't pay any of those taxes. So, you know, offering someone a tax break on a tax that they routinely dodge is actually just going to worry them that they're going to be exposed to the tax man higher than they are already. But yeah, you know, let's find that way through. I firmly believe that there is a possibility for a new deal between tenants and landlords here. They can actually get a better deal for both sides. And just finally, I mean, this is a classic example of this polarised British debate where we end up kind of anti-regulation, pro-regulation, and is it Stalinist, is it kind of violently neoliberal, and, you know, there must be a more sensible way through that. This. And the example I would quote here is the current spat that's going on over planning. But once again, it seems to be boiling down to, is it concrete in the countryside, or absolute nimbyism, no one building anything anywhere? You know, again, there has to be a more balanced, reasonable way through where actually we can deliver something to both sides. Thank you.
Yes, well, thank you for that plea for sanity, though, on a week where we've had a debate about a cat in the immigration system. I'm not sure you're maybe a bit optimistic anyway. Right, okay. Now, a number of issues have come up here. I don't want to guide this conversation. The floor is now everybody else's. But clearly, regulation, too much, too little. And the pitching the point where it comes out right for the largest number of people. The observation that the expansion in the private rented sector is the product of changes in other sectors rather than an artifact in its own right. The issue of how to encourage more investment. We've heard that there are resources waiting to invest, particularly in London, in this part of the housing market, but that it isn't as easy as it might at first seem. Probably bewildering, I suppose, if we find it bewildering, heaven knows what it looks like from Far East or the Middle East. And also this question of transferability of lessons. What is it that allows some lessons from other systems and societies to be capable of being moved? Because we do this in public policy. But what is the miracle ingredient that allows that to happen? And just a few thoughts to get it going. Would anybody like to? I know you will. Anybody would like to? Yes, right. In the best traditions, can you say broadly who you are? I know who you are, but...
I may have missed this because I came in late. Is there anything that Palace can do to incentivise private renting? One of the sort of things that's going around the office at the moment is...
Sorry, can't hear you.
Sorry. Is there anything that planners can do to incentivise private renting? One of the things that's being discussed in City Hall at the moment is would a use tax
the open planning scheme be presumably applied to cheap land as opposed
to normal residential land, and then something that would
prevent changes to
higher land
use.
Michael,
yes.
Speaking as an economist, I'd say that was a subsidy, and it distorts the market. Why do it? There should be better ways of doing that. And unfortunately, once you put those things in, you can't throw them out. It becomes very, very difficult because you're taking poor people's housing or whatever. You know, it becomes a very politicised thing in terms of the way in which you operate it.
Yolanda?
I was very tempted to say, when you said, is there anything planners can do, to answer, stay out of it. I just want to explain why. I think planning use classes are failing in all sorts of areas to provide the sort of, not just housing, but environments that we need going forward. And going back to my point about these sort of hybrids between ownership, renting, perhaps changing over the lifetime and the occupancy of a property, I think we need more flexibility, and we don't want to put people once again into silos. So I think the planning response should be maybe looking favourably on the sort of deal that Evenbrook did in Birmingham, where they said we'll provide sub-market renting here, so a form of affordable rent, for 20 years or 30 years, I can't remember what the time limit was, and after that we'll go back, and you know, that's going to be one of the planning conditions. That's what we offer you in return for giving us this planning permission that you might not otherwise grant on this site for residential. And I think it's that kind of actually very site specific, location specific, community specific sort of deal that's actually going to end up being much more valuable than a blanket planning use class.
Sorry, I'll just defend the planners because, let's face it, our housing market is so wildly dysfunctional and so far away from anything resembling an economist's perfect market that the suggestion that, you know, we just need to stand away from it and the market will resolve it is just laughable. So, you know, yes, I mean, we have to be in the market, absolutely, and we do all the time, whether we like it or not. So, yeah, I think there is some merit in looking at whether the planning system is a way forward. I remain to be convinced whether a use class per se is the way forward, because that does run the risk of kind of creating private rented ghettos in and of itself. A use class that defines a certain chunk of the city as being for very short-term vulnerable lets is kind of a recipe for ghettos.
And you did say, John, it would be on what you think is cheap land, which would sort of reinforce that risk, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Industrial, so 800,000 hectares versus resi at
Okay, fair point, fair point. Okay, now hang on, I've got lots of questions, so I'm going to take these in a group. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That'll be enough, won't it? Okay, say who you are.
Martin Crooks in Independent Planning Consulting. I wondered if the panel and the authors think that this is a sector with potential to help the total stock grow, or whether we're basically talking about sort of internal trades within a zero-sum game within the total stock.
Okay, that's a good question. That's simple. Simple question's good. Gentleman here, then we'll move backwards. Yeah.
Brian Ham, executive of the Dolphin Square Foundation. We're a privately endowed charity that does private rental sector and institutes affordable. Two points. One, a reply on planning. There is one very simple, petty rule that could be got rid of that would help. Where a private sector developer has a Section 106 obligation to do affordable housing, we have a regulation at the moment that requires that is managed through a registered provider. I don't know why, it just introduces another party and another round of inefficiencies, potentially. So striking that regulation out would be a very simple and easy thing to do. The second is really a comment on the opportunity to use periodic tenancies, AST tenancies, effectively an open-ended tenancy, subject to an appropriate termination period on either side. And of course, the problem at the moment with a 5-year AST is that the tenant is tied in for 5 years. If they got a job somewhere else, they'd be in very difficult terrain. But I don't know why we don't use more periodic tenancies. Some observations from anybody here would be really helpful there. I think there's a myth that it empowers the tenant and you can't get rid. Our legal advice is that isn't the case. And it's actually a very good and flexible tenancy that should and could be used more often.
Okay, good question to you.
Yep.
Rachel Blake from East London Housing Partnership.
I think you're going to have to speak slightly towards the back of the room as well as towards the front of the room. Sorry about that.
Okay. Rachel Blake, East London Housing Partnership for Local Authority in East London. I wonder what the authors and panel had to say about public investment in the private rental sector. It was interesting what Belinda said about how the social rental sector, you could call it private rental sector, bank investment, could equally call the private rental sector actually is taking up a lot of social housing needs at the moment, particularly in East London. Local authorities use loads of private rental accommodation to house homeless families through the temporary accommodation or the homeless prevention. Embarking in Dagenham, we estimate that 66% of the housing sector is paid for by housing benefit, and we've got about 48.9. Can we use those two major forms of subsidy in a more efficient way and do place those things to more efficient?
Okay, that may be one for Christine and Kath as well. You can, of course, speak. And there were questions going in a line. Yep, you.
Yes, you. Sorry, we're not part of East London, but I'm from Loughborough Viewham, and I was just going to say that we've had an interesting debate with the GLA around regulation and no regulation, and we just started last week on a borough-wide consultation for 100% landlord licensing, and this would encompass about 35,000 dwellings in Europe, which is about a third of the housing stock now, and the current world's going to change. We'll have a higher number of private renters than we will own occupiers in the next 4 years. So I think the London housing market is kind of complex, and it might require different answers. And the legislation is incredibly clunky as well, and we're not defenders of regulated legislation, but we feel that will provide a framework for some wider initiatives around resilience that we're trying to get to East London.
Forgive me, this is my point, I've lost the thread just at the very end there. What are you suggesting? I'm sure everybody else got it, but I didn't.
It's a wider issue around resilience to enable our private tenants to have the quality and safety and security that they should have in their homes that at the moment we can't deliver.
But are you asking for more regulation or
we
longer?
We are. Okay.
And there was one other question around that area. Has East London had its say yet? Or you're not from East London?
I'm Robert Taylor from the Canada and Federation of Private Tenants.
Right.
I'm interested to know what the panel thinks about why tenants as consumers are not able to influence improvements in the market. Do you think that is down to a lack of security of tenure and rights, or do you think there's other reasons? Because it seems that consumers in other markets can... that's to improve standards, but not in private banking sector. I mean, the second one is about the role of intermediaries in the market. I mean, obviously now a lot of transactions are carried out not between the tenant and the landlord, but between tenants and agents. And they seem to be very good at not only ripping off tenants, but also ripping off landlords. So I would be very interested to know whether the book looks at not just landlords, but also their agents, and what the panel thinks, whether they think they're a force to do or a force to ban.
Right, any agents in the audience?
No.
Anyway, now I'm going to allow the panel to kind of... I'll try and ensure each question is answered. I've written them all down myself, but... Toby.
Okay, what should I have something on? The new experiment, more power to your elbow, and I wish you all the best with it, and I would be very interested in it. I suppose the only point to make is that kind of licensing or registration of landlords is kind of an essential first step. At the moment, we don't even know who they are. Like there is no record of what homes are in the private rented sector. We don't even count them. Our estimations are based on census data and stuff. It's shocking, frankly, just how little we actually know about this sector. So if we're going to actually influence it in any way, the first step is just to know where it is. So yes, absolutely. But in itself, I don't think it will necessarily solve that many problems. It is just a necessary first step. On the role of agents, yes, absolutely. And actually, in my quest to kind of find a common cause with the landlord so that we can find a way through this kind of often too polarised debate, perhaps you're right, and actually we should both just be picking on the agents as the real villains of the piece, because, as you say, they are actually very effective at gouging both sides of the equation. And I've spoken to landlords who will say that, but their agents phone them up at kind of 9 at night saying, you should be raising your rent. And they say, they're a nice family, I don't want them to leave, and they're actually being bullied by their agents to behave in a more aggressive manner than they would like to. So yes, I'm at, for my sins, I'm actually going to an agents' conference tomorrow, so we'll see how that goes.
Convey the friendly warmth when you get there, yes. Richard, would you like to choose something that I used to answer?
Yeah, I'll pick up on two, actually. One on the the discussion about potential restrictive market around registered providers taking out the affordable stock. I think that's interesting regulatory issue. If it does result in restrictive market, I think it needs to be looked at. But there is a very good reason, I think, for government historically working that way, because it's allocated grant to those organisations, and it wants those organisations to be accountable for the use of that grant, and provisions around quality reinforce that requirement. And historically, I mean, I worked with the HCA, or the Housing Corporation, when the market was opened up for the first time for the private sector to bid for grants, and the response was very, very poor. That might have pleased some politicians and civil servants, but the reality was the market didn't respond when the opportunity was there. I think so we're locked in where we are now. Rachel's point on a pick-up on local authorities' involvement, well, I mean, there's some very significant reforms next year on the housing revenue account reforms that will give local authorities a lot more, I think, influence and power over their local housing markets. Now, again, I think the current government missed a trick by applying a level of restrictions on the use of housing resources that I think are unhelpful. And just way of illustration, the average level of debt for a unit of social housing in a local authority's balance sheet next year will be about half of that of a very similar housing association, which means there's a lot of borrowing investment potential locked up in local authorities that local authorities won't be able to access in the short term, which I think is a great pity at a point in time where we are now in the economic fiscal cycle. But at the same time, we're working with a whole series of authorities around how some of that potential might be unlocked, and I think we'd be missing a trick if local authorities with greater freedoms simply retreated back into managing and operating social housing in the limited way they've been doing so the last 50 years or so.
You think that they will simply, in effect, continue to, given they are in a relatively, most of them, or many of them, in a relatively strong financial position, just defend that position rather than using the resources?
I think that is, in many places, very likely.
Okay. Right. Good. Not good. Yolanda.
Right.
reverse order. I'm not an agent, as I keep telling people, I'm not an estate agent, but maybe I
can. You know,
yes, I do work with a few of them, though. My impression is that at our end of the market, all the agents that I know, the letting agents, are very keen to be licensed, regulated, yeah, or whatever. So, I think there are agents and agents here. One thought occurred to me is that maybe the problem, if we're looking for more professionalism in management, why do we have an agency system? I mean, forget agents, of course, the reason they want to up the rent is because they get a percentage of rent. If you started paying them actually professionals' fees to give proper advice to investors for what the investor wants, a long-term tenancy, maybe low rent, whatever it is, we might get a slightly different result. So that's just something to put out there. I have to say I'm very proud to have been involved in Newham with an organisation called Local Space, which was set up to, and I hope this starts to sort of answer your first question about the sort of public sector involvement in the private sector. What Local Space were doing was actually buying street properties out of landlords, private landlords' hands, in order to house homeless people. And it was a fantastic thing to do. What horrifies me and has done for years is the way that the public sector, this giant procurer, seems to have no power over the product it's procuring. I can't think of any other area of even public procurement, which is of course notorious to being as well, but certainly in the private sector, any other area of procurement where they could have less power. And yet the very worst properties, landlords, conditions and so forth seem to be being procured. I'm not sure the answer is always to sort of try and turn that around, because for one thing it demanded a huge amount of funding. It was an RSL. But I think the public sector does have to get to grips with and try to use its power as a procurer to procure adequate and accommodation. I find it extraordinary that decent public sector providers can step into the gap in some cases. I think there's also a role there. There was one other thing. I'm not going to comment on periodic tenancies, but I think your point about internal trades inside a zero-sum game was a very pertinent one. And really, it's only worth talking about this if we're actually talking about an overall increase in housing supply, because that's the real and underlying problem. And fiddling about with 10 years is actually kind of fiddling at the edges. The reason this is important is because I think we're actually facing a period, I think, where rents are going to outperform capital growth. And particularly, there will be a market that continues to grow in value that's fed by equity and owner-occupiers. But at the other end, I think there's an increasing block of property that's going to be driven, its value will be driven by rental income and income flows. And as I alluded to earlier, that's beginning to unlock land that wouldn't otherwise be unlocked for residential development. So I don't think it's a zero-sum game.
Michael? I'll stick my neck out and see if I can get Toby to agree with me. What we really don't have enough of in this country is enforcement of what exists at present. And unfortunately, on comparative stuff, we don't know what they do over there, but we could certainly learn some lessons in that school. And I think that's a very important ground thing, because if you have yet more regulations, and you know they're not enforced, they don't mean a thing. Now, there are lots of problems with licensing landlords, and if you're going to do it in Newham, I'd suggest you look at what's happened in Scotland. It's been phenomenally expensive. Even when they got a list, they don't know what to do with it. And the problem in the private rent sector is this churn. So if you've got a list, you can guarantee a month later it's out of date. And all those things mean that licensing itself doesn't actually do very much, except waste a lot of your rather short money, I spark of thought. And it's this link. You need something that you can actually go in there with a big stick when it's necessary. And we don't have those big sticks. Or we do in law, but we don't have in practice. And I think that's a terrible shame about the way in which the private rented sector works. In terms of private investment in the private rented sector, one of the really interesting chapters in the book is the American one, and they have lots of these different schemes. It actually is part of this convergence between social housing and private rented sector, and they're not universal things. So in that context, I think there's a lot of opportunity for thinking of things in that context. Now, this thing about long-term tenants is that there's one thing that's hugely different in residential from commercial. If you get a long-term contract in the commercial sector, they will force you into liquidation if you don't pay that contract for as long as it lasts. In other words, it's not an asymmetrical contract, it's a symmetrical contract. And the problem in the residential sector is, yeah, you can get a symmetrical contract. I had one a few years ago for a number of years, and the guy was overjoyed. I got the rent down, we were both happy. He turned out to be a crook, but that's another matter. at one point we were happy. But the point is, you can't say you're going to do all this, but I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do. And that's the difficulty in negotiating in that context. It means those sorts of contracts become very expensive and hard to agree.
Right. And does anybody deal with the tenants as consumers point?
Well, I can figure that out quickly. And yes, it is a big question. Why? And the short answer as to why the consumer pressure doesn't work in this market is firstly because just the demand supply equation is so stark that consumers just have no power. Secondly, these are people's homes. You know, this is not like, you know, if you don't like a restaurant's food, you'll just won't go there again. This is your home. You don't want to have to move. It's a very illiquid market, right? And actually, you know, we know that one of the biggest problems about enforcement, I absolutely do agree with Michael, there is a real problem about is that the tenants suffering rogue landlords won't complain. Because they know the first thing will happen is that they lose their home, either because the landlord will throw them out of you know, by being vindictive, or because actually the council will come around and say this place is unfit to live. Out you go. So you know, until we get that kind of greater security that means that tenants actually have confidence that they can make complaints, their consumer power is irrelevant.
Christine, now you're going to have to stand up.
I'm going to stand up. I'm going to go side. It's easier. I'm not going to say very much anyway. I actually cannot really see this registered provider argument. On the registered provider side, you're giving a relatively small grant. On the housing benefits side, you're giving a relatively large continuous revenue factory. And why is one set of people being treated in one way, while the other, much more usual type of provider, who's getting a whacking great subsidy from housing benefit, being completely free of all of these regulations? It doesn't make sense to me, and I don't think it should make sense. And I think that it's partly about departmental issues, one's the DWP and one's DCLG, partly about prudential issues, but the logic of it is not there. And I do think that matters, because we have got 40% of private tenants eligible for housing benefit at the present time, and we will have more. So that's one issue. I think that links to the question of what type of licensing are we talking about. And we do have some examples in other countries of really effective licensing of potential landlords for vulnerable households who are getting housing benefit, etc., in this context. I'm afraid, I actually think, we have to have a voluntary licensing system which carries a hallmark, a brand. And we'll all be mostly Yolanda's friends. But in time, it will be wider than that. Because there is a massive benefit to landlords to being registered, to being seen to be good in an environment where many people are quite clearly bad. That does mean you have to enforce at the bottom end of the system in a quite different way. But it's a very suboptimal solution, but I think it's the only way. Absolutely legal, everybody's got to be licensed, doesn't work, and we know it doesn't work. The third question is, can the planners help? I think planners can help in making the tenants stop growth. I think we can have better
understanding at site level the sorts of Section 106 type agreements, and we can have better understanding of the types of built form which work. But I think it does get linked to this question of, can you ever have a single owner of a property, because that is the thing which really works for smaller and larger apartment blocks. While we have the capacity always to allow one bit of it to become owner-occupied, we can't get many of those economies of scale. I think I will stop that there.
Right, thank you very much. It's... Yes, well, yeah, no, this is one quick point. Make it quick, short and sharp.
The price is
Tuesday, 18th of October at, is it being launched physically or just electronically?
Online,
low cost.
Hopefully we will be able to look back over the other ones earlier and see whether this issue about landlords turning over, which has been there always from the 70s, really works, and see it in that context. Can I just say, just the one thing which comes out of all of this is we've got frightened landlords by the possibility of regulation which might not even affect them or might make it better for them. We've got frightened tenants because they might be kicked out. That, how do we deal with that fear to get something rational seems to be the political issue, not economists have little to say on it, but it's phenomenally important in what's going on. Because when we, and I'm sure others have done the same thing, when we looked at the sort of rent control story, 90% of the landlords who were so worried about it were never going to be affected by it. So,
yeah. Okay, well, thanks for that. Thank you all for coming along. I think it's been a fascinating series of events. This one, I think, has been scintillating in the sense that there were short, sharp contributions from the panel, and indeed a series of, quite a long series of interesting questions from the floor, and we've had them all answered quickly, so it's all been rather business-like, which is good. Just to pick up on what Christine was saying at the end there, we are, and as Toby was implying, talking about, in a sense, not only for a very large number of people their homes, but for another very large number of people, benign landlord, their incomes. And I mean, their homes and their incomes as an issue does touch people a great deal more, and in obvious ways, but more directly than other abstractions, and I take the point of Toby's point exactly about the future of planning. They are rather more abstract, whichever side you're on. So I can see why this particular issue generates so much interest and concern, and therefore myth. I'll only add that the copies of the much discussed and indeed praised, I had nothing to do with it, despite Ben Cochin's best efforts, report is available outside, as will be a drink, and no doubt some of the LSE's finest peanuts and other nibbles.
Better than that,
I'm told. So thank you for all coming. For those who've come to more than one, or even if you haven't, thank you for coming this afternoon, and doubtless we shall see you all again soon. So thanks very much.
People want more than two copies of the book.